All right, so Isaiah, if you got your finger in the passage there, let's turn and read it. Isaiah chapter 9, starting at verse 1. But there will be no gloom for her who was in anguish. In the former time, he brought into contempt the land of Zebulun and the land of Naphtali. But in the latter time, he has made glorious the way of the sea, the land beyond the Jordan, Galilee of the nations. The people who walked in darkness have seen a great light. Those who dwelt in a land of deep darkness, on them has light shone. You have multiplied the nation. You have increased its joy. They rejoice before you as with joy at the harvest, as they are glad when they divide the spoil. For the yoke of his burden and the staff for his shoulder, the rod of his oppressor, you have broken as on the day of Midian. For every boot of the tramping warrior in battle tumult and every garment rolled in blood will be burned as fuel for the fire. For to us a child is born, to us a son is given, and the government shall be upon his shoulder, and his name shall be called Wonderful Counselor, Mighty God, Everlasting Father, Prince of Peace. Of the increase of his government and of peace, there will be no end. On the throne of David and over his kingdom, to establish it and to uphold it, with justice and with righteousness, from this time forth and forevermore, the zeal of the Lord of hosts will do this.
Well, good evening, and welcome to this very late service. I am frankly surprised so many people have shown up. We're blowing right through nap time. I feel like I need a juice box or a coffee. But well done, you're all clearly present, and it appears through this kind of spotlight that you are paying attention. In fact, can we turn it down a little bit? I feel like with my white skin, I'm reaching a stage of bioluminescence. That's good. My name is Matt. I'm one of the pastors at this church. A particularly warm welcome to those people that are new amongst us this evening, and to Vic Kuntz, who the regulars at church will know. Vic's here this evening. It's so lovely to have you here, Vic. Well, I thought one way of keeping you on your toes at 9:31 in the evening is a little quiz. So here it is. Oh, you're so excited, I know. What I'm going to do is I'm going to read you some lines from about six Christmas carols. Don't worry, it's not the whole carol. And then a couple of verses from the Bible. And your job is to work out what the repeating theme is. What is the repeated theme? And that is not including, obviously, Christmas or Jesus. They're right out. I'm not after them. It's a carol. It's going to be about those two things. I want a different theme that is repeated in all of these verses. All right. Here we go. O come, thou dayspring, come and cheer our spirits by thine advent here. Disperse the gloomy clouds of night and death's dark shadow put to flight. Rejoice, rejoice, Emmanuel shall come to thee, O Israel. Joyful all ye nations rise, join the triumph of the skies. The thrill of hope, the weary world rejoices, for yonder breaks a new and glorious morn. Joy to the world, the Lord has come, let earth receive her King. Put your hand up if you think you've worked it out. Echoing their joyous strains, Gloria in excelsis Deo. Don't be ashamed, the more people have it, the quicker I stop. Raise a song on high, the virgin sings her lullaby. Joy, joy, for Christ is born, the babe, the son of Mary. O come, all ye faithful, joyful and triumphant. But the angel said to them, do not be afraid. I bring you good news that will cause great joy for all people. When they saw the star, they... Really? No one? Yeah, okay. They rejoiced exceedingly with great joy. And the last one, you've probably all worked it out. Yeah, it's joy. Well done. Well done. Last one from our passage, Isaiah 9. You have multiplied the nation. You have increased its joy. They rejoice before you as with joy at the harvest, as they are joyful when they divide the spoil. Joy it is. And joy isn't just a Jesus-y thing this time of year. We may have, by and large, got rid of the baby in the manger, but it is still joy that is on the table. In fact, joy is being sold in countless shopping centres and supermarkets across Australia today. And you can often kind of see pictures of it. You have the ruby red lobster, the bronze roasted potatoes, the ham glazed to within an inch of its dead life, crackling, forming an almost golden husk around a heavenly roast, crisp and sparkling champagne. This might, click's not working, next slide and next slide. Not as smooth as I was hoping. This might indeed conjure up pictures of the ultimate Aussie feast. But of course, it's not just on the table, is it? There are the presents, the on-point fashion items, the latest and brightest Apple product, or if you luck out, Samsung. The little golden retriever puppy, if my wife is listening. The shiny new insert X. All offering the promise of joy round the Christmas tree. And yet, whether it's the joy of the stuffing or the joy of the shiny, the joy seems, if not fanciful, then at best fleeting. There one moment, gone the next. In fact, for many, it's not joy but distress that the season brings. Meant to be a season of light, but it casts a dark shadow as people nurse hangovers, crippling credit card debt and the like. And even those that avoid the excesses of the season, the stress of the season, who enjoy Christmas for what it's worth, there still seems to be something missing. That perfect picture of a Christmas banquet on the beach, it never quite matches our reality. Christmas is a bit like vanilla-flavoured tea. No offence, flavoured tea drinkers. The smell of vanilla-flavoured tea promises so much, doesn't it? And yet it tastes like boiling water. Now, don't mistake me, I'm no grouch, and if you know me, you know I'm jingling all the way. I love Christmas. But we have to be honest and say that it can leave a bad taste in our mouth. It can sour and disappoint. And why is that? Why is it that it never seems to reach the lofty heights you expect? Well, in one sense, and in a significant sense, it shouldn't surprise us, should it? That our experience of Christmas is a bit of a mixed bag, a mixture of joy, delight, and then disappointment and despair, is of course our reality and our experience of reality of our lives. Our best moments are often tinged with sadness, aren't they? The poet John Keats lamented, "I, in the very temple of delight, veiled melancholy has her sovereign shrine." And if you don't understand Middle English, the Buddha put it like this, "It is sometimes in the happiest moments that sadness pierces through." There is joy, but it is often sour. And I think that sourness, that restless dissatisfaction with what life offers is actually there as a signpost to point beyond. If our hope, and think about what's hope. Hope at its heart is an expectation of future joy. I think that's a pretty good definition of hope, an expectation of future joy. And if that expectation is tethered completely to the here and now, to this temporal frame, then our experience of this finite will never be enough for us. The Apostle Paul calls it the world's bondage to frustration. There's sand in the gears and the cogs of life. It never works just as well as it should. Joy, if attained, is never sustained. And that frustration is no accident. God subjected it to frustration. And what that frustration does is it points us beyond the here and now. It points us to the something more on the horizon. And you know that this is philosophically bulletproof because James Bond agrees. This world is not enough. Or the pop band Bastille sing, "There's a hole in my soul, I can feel it. I can feel it." Or as we'll sing as we close this evening, "Long lay the world in sin and error pining." In fact, I think no one more so perhaps than Blaise Pascal, a mathematician and philosopher, has really captured the essence of this. It's a long quote, but bear with me. "There once was in man a true happiness, of which now remain to him only the mark and empty trace, which he in vain tries to fill from all his surroundings, seeking from things absent the help he does not obtain in the things present. But these are all inadequate, because the infinite abyss can only be filled by an infinite and immutable, unchanging object. That is to say, only by God himself." The fragility of our joy and happiness points us to our need beyond, our need for the infinite. And I think actually deep down, theist, agnostic, atheist, spiritualist, deep down, I think we know that this is true. That if we live for the here and now, if we live to suck the marrow from the bone of existence, if we really carpe our diem, we actually don't find peace, but restlessness. The more we seek it, the more it evades us. And no one has perhaps pontificated and philosophized on this subject more profoundly than King Solomon. And he says that God has set eternity in our hearts. Or the 4th century theologian Augustine says, "Our hearts are restless until we find you." It is only when we find God, when we have relationship with him, is our soul made replete and complete. "Till he appeared and the soul felt its worth. The thrill of hope, the weary world rejoices, for yonder breaks a new and glorious morn." The true joy of Christmas, the lasting joy, is God's gift of himself to us, wrapped in swaddling clothes in a manger. Emmanuel, God is with us, among us, offering us life and life eternal. And so if the life, the joy that this life has to offer you has left a sour taste in your life, if you reflect on your eternal hoping and expecting that the next Christmas, the next New Year, the next holiday will bring you that elusive joy, realize that it won't. And listen to the song singer of the Bible when he says, "Taste and see that the Lord is good." Seek that baby in the manger, bow to him like the wise men, and find joy's truest source. And yet, even if you do that, as many no doubt here this evening have, even then it's still a conflicted joy, isn't it? And I wonder whether you picked up at the end of that reading in the book of Matthew, you have Herod slaying all the infants in Bethlehem. A brutal murder, one of many that Herod did during his reign. And that is a stark reminder of this truth, that our joy is never uncontaminated, is never unadulterated by the fact that there are many, many in the world who, while we are rejoicing, are suffering. One Aussie journalist, she put it like this And this is the end of 2016, but I think it still counts in 2017. She says, "Here in coastal Australia, our streets are studded with opening frangipani. The air is thick with heat and salt, school uniforms folded away for a year, and a sticky summer awaits. But an odd feeling of impotent despair has infected our conversations and our celebrations this year. Aleppo, Brexit, climate change, fracturing global accord, partisan ugliness, and an atmosphere of cheap shots and short-term gain." And in this sense, it would only be a selfish and an unreflective person whose joy remains unaffected by the pain and the suffering of others. You could put it like this: our joy is always conflicted because we live in a world of conflicts. Because it's not just conflict on the streets of Syria, it's not just cars running through people in Melbourne, it's also the restless conflict of our hearts. And so if there is a hope of a pure and sustained joy, then the horrors of war, the hostility of nations, the enmity and rage of our world and of our hearts mustn't just pause for a second, but it must cease. To put it a different way, for there to be joy, there must be peace. And Isaiah chapter 9, which we read from a little earlier, that's exactly what is promised there. And so we're going to go through it really quickly. I know we're late at night. Next slide. Starts off with this: "The people who walked in darkness have seen a great light. Those who dwelt in a land of deep darkness, on them a light has shone." So it begins with this offer of hope, this light in a dark landscape. Next verse. "Then we have the joy. You have multiplied the nation. You have increased its joy. They rejoice before you as with joy at the harvest, as they are glad when they divide the spoil." So here we have this kind of three or four times offered true lasting joy. And then you go, what's the conditions? What's the basis upon which this joy can be offered? Verse 4 and 5. "For the yoke of his burden and the staff for his shoulder, the rod of his oppressor, you have broken as on the day of Midian. For every boot of the trampling warrior in battle tumult and every garment rolled in blood will be burnt as fuel for the fire." We have here the cessation, the stopping of oppression and war. And not just a pause, but the destruction of war's destruction. "And every garment rolled in blood will be burned as fuel for the fire." It's the picture of war being cremated and its remains scattered through eternity, never to rise again. And so think of the logic. You have the hope, you have the joy, then the condition of the joy, you've got peace. And then once we have the peace, we have the source of that peace. Verse 6. Next slide. "For to us a child is born, to us a son is given, and the government shall be upon his shoulders, and his name shall be Wonderful Counselor, Mighty God, Everlasting Father, Prince of Peace." This bringer of hope, this promiser of eternal joy, the fount and source of eternal peace, is offered by a God who, unlike the politicians of our day and every day, unlike the powerful of our day and every day, uses all his might, uses all his authority to love and serve his people and offer them peace and mercy. It's a God whose face we glimpse in the manger. And look at this peace, verse 7. "Of the increase of his government and of peace there will be no end. On the throne of David and over his kingdom, to establish it and to uphold it with justice and righteousness from this time forth and forevermore, the zeal of the Lord of hosts will do this." It's an unrelenting, unyielding, unceasing picture of beauty and peace. And how is it that God Almighty, come as baby, achieves this? Well, we read later in the same book of Isaiah, some 30 chapters later, these immortal words. Speaking of this son born, he was pierced for our transgressions. He was crushed for our iniquities. Upon him was the chastisement that brought us peace, and with his wounds we are healed. God achieves this peace through his own pain and suffering. His blood shed on the cross for us. And as we think of those slain innocent children of Bethlehem, we think of the one and only innocent from Bethlehem, God's Son, slain. And in his death, bearing all the world's rage, wrath and malice, all the darkness of the universe, born within himself to bring it to an end within himself. And his resurrection proves his victory over this dark hostility, and his resurrection crowns him as this king of eternal peace. And it's only in that eternal kingdom where unconflicted eternal joy is offered. And if that all sounds a bit too good to be true, that's because it is only experienced in part now. We taste the peace and joy in our hearts, in our lives, in our gospel-shaped community. We see a picture of this. But it is a foretaste. The world around us, and you'll need no convincing of this, it still churns with conflict. It still roils in rage, and sometimes our hearts within reflect the rage outside of us. And so the joy of Christmas is still conflicted. It is still as bittersweet as it was 2,000 years ago. But the Christian's hope, that promise of future joy, it is not conflicted. It has no sourness, no taint, because it anticipates a future kingdom. A kingdom forged in Jesus' death on the cross, guaranteed in his resurrection, and made universal when he returns. For every boot of the trampling warrior in battle tumult, and every garment rolled in blood will be burned as fuel for the fire. For to us a child is born, to us a son is given, and the government shall be on his shoulder, and his name shall be called Wonderful Counselor, Mighty God, Everlasting Father, Prince of Peace. The thrill of hope, the weary world rejoices, for yonder breaks a new and glorious morn.